Okay, so we're diving into State of New Jersey v. Michael Tafaro. And wow, this case, it's got it all. Restraining orders, online shenanigans, and a whole lot of back and forth in the courts.
Yeah, it really takes you on a ride, doesn't it? And what we have is some guidance for the podcast, laying out the case background, the procedural history, how it went through the courts, the legal issues at play, the reasoning of the court, and takeaways, especially about judicial conduct, which I think we'll get into. It's fascinating.
It is. And we've also got a perplexity analysis and a good old-fashioned case brief.
Right, giving us all those extra details about the facts, how the case moved through the system, what the Supreme Court of New Jersey finally decided.
So today, we're going to try to cut to the chase and pull out the most important takeaways from all of this and see why this case still matters, especially when we think about what a fair trial actually means.
Absolutely.
And this is where it gets interesting.
Yeah, what I find so interesting from the start is how this, seemingly simple contempt charge, violating a restraining order, opens up these really big questions about what a judge is supposed to do and the rights of the defendant in a trial. We've got a lot to unpack here.
We do. So let's go back to the very beginning. What was the initial incident that set this whole legal battle in motion? What happened between Michael and Susan Tafaro?
Well, at the heart of it was this dispute between Michael and Susan over their parents' estate.
Ah, family matters, always tricky.
Indeed. And it escalated to the point where a restraining order was issued against Michael in January 2004.
You all right?
And the order was very specific. It prohibited him from having any contact with Susan, direct or indirect, except through their lawyers. So, they drew a clear line in the sand, legally speaking.
Right, the legal boundary was established. Very common, of course, in these kinds of, heated family disputes. But then things took a turn, and
Yeah.
not in the direction you'd expect.
Right. Fast forward to the very late hours of March 29th, 2004. Around midnight, Susan gets this weird phone call.
Midnight. Ominous.
Yeah. And the caller asked for, quote, the lady of the house.
The lady of the house. That's strange.
It is. And the next morning, Susan finds this obscene advertisement on Craigslist.
Whoa, an obscene Craigslist ad. That's a pretty big jump from estate disputes. What was obscene about it, and how did they know it was targeting Susan specifically?
Well, for starters, it was posted in the casual encounters section, and it offered sexual favors. And here's the kicker: it included Susan's unlisted phone number.
Unlisted phone number. That is targeted. You
Yeah.
don't just stumble upon someone's unlisted number, so
Yeah.
the police get involved.
They do.
Yeah.
And their investigation traces the Craigslist posting back to a computer linked to Michael Tafaro.
So it seems pretty open and shut. Restraining order, inappropriate contact using the internet. It's traced back to his computer. End of story.
Well, not quite.
Of course not. It's a legal deep dive. There's always a twist. So what was Michael's side of the story?
Michael's defense was that he wasn't the one who actually posted the ad.
Okay.
He said some friends of his used his computer without his knowledge, and they were the ones who put it up. He even named them Daniel Eng and Redner Porkala.
So he's pointing the finger at his friends. Convenient. But wait, there's more, right?
Yeah.
Because his friends, they didn't exactly back him up.
Yeah, this is where it gets really interesting.
Anyway.
Both Daniel Eng and Redner Porkala, they testified in court, and they flat out contradicted Michael's story.
No way.
Yes, they both stated under oath that it was him, Michael, who posted that Craigslist ad.
Wow. So now it's a he said, they said situation.
Exactly. It all boiled down to who the jury believed. This conflict in testimony was the crux of the entire case.
So based on all this, Michael is charged with fourth-degree contempt for violating that restraining order. But it doesn't stop there, does it?
Nope. This is where our legal roller coaster ride really begins.
Yeah.
This case went to trial not once, not twice, but three times.
Three times. Okay, talk about a legal saga. Tell me everything.
So, the first trial, Michael's convicted. But that conviction, get this, is overturned by the New Jersey Supreme Court.
Overturned. Well, they don't just do that lightly. There
Yeah.
must have been some serious issues with that first trial.
There were. And then they had the second trial,
Okay.
and that ended in a mistrial.
A mistrial. So something went wrong there, too.
Right. It means the jury couldn't reach a valid verdict for, various reasons, but we don't have the specifics here.
Gotcha. So two trials down, no resolution, but then they went for round three.
They did. And this time, Michael's convicted again. He gets 4 years of probation and some conditions attached to that.
4 years of probation for a Craigslist ad. That's something. It really highlights the potential consequences of violating court orders. But wait, the story's not over yet.
Nope, he appealed again.
Of course he did. This case just keeps on giving. It really shows how important it is to get these things right, procedurally speaking.
Absolutely. These repeated appeals mean Michael and his lawyers believe there were some significant problems with how the trials were conducted, problems that might have led to an unfair result. And that brings us to the core legal issues that were front and center in that final appeal to the New Jersey Supreme Court.
Okay, so what were the main points Michael's lawyers raised in this last appeal? What were they challenging about the trial?
There were two main arguments. First, they argued that the way the trial judge questioned Michael during the trial unfairly suggested to the jury that the judge didn't believe him. Remember, this whole case was about who was more believable, Michael or his friends.
Right. It was all about credibility. So if the judge seemed skeptical, that could have swayed the jury. What was the second argument?
The second issue was about the prosecutor's line of questioning. The defense argued that the prosecutor violated Michael's right to remain silent by asking him about things he didn't say to his lawyer.
So basically, they were saying the trial wasn't fair because the judge was biased and the prosecutor overstepped. Two pretty big claims.
They are. And these are both fundamental legal issues that go to the heart of a fair trial.
So how did the Supreme Court rule on these two key points?
Well, they agreed with Michael on the first issue about the judge's questioning. They said it was improper and created a risk of bias. But their decision on the second issue, the one about the prosecutor's questions, was more nuanced. They didn't give a clear win to the defense on that one.
Nuanced meaning they didn't say the prosecutor was wrong, but they didn't say he was right either.
Right. They acknowledged that this kind of questioning is tricky and can be dangerous, but in this specific case, they didn't find it to be a clear violation of Michael's rights. But as we'll see, they did issue a warning to the prosecutor about it for any potential retrial.
Okay, so the big win for Michael was the Supreme Court's finding about the judge's behavior. Let's break that down. What exactly did the court find so wrong with the judge's questioning that they had to overturn the whole conviction?
The court said, and this is key, that the judge's questioning, even if it wasn't openly aggressive or biased, still had the potential to show the jury that the judge didn't believe Michael. And since the entire case hinged on who the jury believed, any hint of skepticism from the judge could have had a huge influence on their decision.
And it wasn't just what the judge asked, but how much he asked, right?
Exactly. The court pointed out that the judge asked Michael almost as many questions as the prosecutor did during cross-examination. That's a lot. And the court felt that this level of questioning from the judge, especially combined with the types of questions he asked, made it seem like he was taking sides, acting more like a prosecutor than a neutral judge.
It's like he was advocating against Michael. Were there any specific examples of the judge's questions that the court highlighted as especially problematic?
Yes, there were. For example, they pointed to the judge's repeated questions about why Michael didn't confront his friends, Eng and Portella, about the ad, if he really had nothing to do with it. The court said this kind of questioning coming from the judge could easily make the jury think that the judge doubted Michael's story.
It puts the defendant on the spot, even when it's not the prosecutor doing the grilling.
Right. And the court emphasized that while judges can and sometimes should ask questions to clarify things or get more details, they have to be incredibly careful and impartial when doing so, especially when they're questioning the defendant in a criminal trial. In this case, the Supreme Court felt that the judge crossed the line, creating a real risk of an unfair trial. That's why they called it reversible error, meaning the error was serious enough to justify overturning the conviction.
And that quote from Chief Justice Ravner really gets to the heart of the matter, doesn't it? He said, and I'm quoting here, "The court's questions had the capacity to signal disbelief. It wasn't about proving that the judge was intentionally biased, but recognizing the impact his questions could have on the jury."
Exactly. It's not just about what the judge meant to do, but how it could be perceived. And this underscores just how important it is for judges to be truly neutral, especially in cases where credibility is everything.
Okay, let's move on to the second issue in the appeal, the one about the prosecutor's questions about what Michael didn't tell his lawyer before the trial. You said the Supreme Court's decision on this was more nuanced. What was their reasoning?
Here, the court made a really important distinction between what's called pre-arrest silence and post-arrest silence. They said that if a defendant doesn't say something before they're arrested and Mirandized, the prosecutor might be able to use that silence later to challenge the defendant's story in court.
I see. So because Michael said his friends posted the ad, the fact that he might not have told his lawyer that right away, before he was arrested, could be used by the prosecutor to imply he wasn't being truthful.
That's the general idea.
Okay.
But the court also made it very clear that the Fifth Amendment protects the right to remain silent after someone's been arrested and read their Miranda rights. So asking a defendant about why they stayed silent after they were arrested would be totally off limits.
So in Michael's case, the prosecutor's questions were about things he didn't say before he was arrested. So the Supreme Court said those questions were technically allowed.
Yes. But, and this is the nuance we talked about, the court gave a warning to prosecutors about this kind of questioning. They said it can be very tricky and could even step on the defendant's right to remain silent after arrest, even indirectly. And it can confuse the jury.
It sounds like a tightrope walk for prosecutors.
Yeah.
How do they ask about pre-arrest silence without making the jury think the defendant is being shady for staying silent after arrest?
That's the challenge. And that's why the court issued the warning. They were saying, be careful. Just because you can ask these questions doesn't mean you should. There's a real risk of making the jury prejudiced against the defendant.
So this case, which started with a crazy Craigslist ad and a restraining order, turns into this huge lesson about fair trials, the power of judges, and the right to remain silent. The fact that it took three trials and multiple appeals shows just how important these legal principles are.
Absolutely. And as you said earlier, it really makes you think, how many other cases, ones that didn't get this much attention, might have turned out differently if judges and prosecutors weren't so carefully scrutinized? It's a reminder that we have to constantly work to make sure our legal system is truly fair.
Right. So for our listeners out there, especially those of you who are going to be lawyers one day, what are the big takeaways from this case? What should we learn from State of New Jersey v. Michael Tafaro about how trials should be run and the rights of defendants?
Well, I think there are some key lessons here, especially for future legal professionals. First, it really drives home the importance of judges staying neutral and not trying to influence the jury, especially when they're questioning witnesses, and even more so when it's the defendant in a criminal case. Judges have to be aware that even small things they do or say can be seen as biased. And even if they don't mean to be biased, it can still damage the fairness of the trial.
Right. And it's not just about the words they use, but how often they ask questions, the tone they use, and what they focus on. Especially in a case where the big question is who's telling the truth.
Exactly. Even if the questions seem neutral, if a judge keeps digging into the weaknesses of one side's case, it can influence the jury. And the second big lesson is about the right to remain silent. While there are situations where prosecutors can use a defendant's silence before arrest to challenge their story, they have to be incredibly careful about it. They can't make it seem like the defendant is being punished for staying silent after arrest. It's a fine line, and it's easy to cross it.
So this case, it started with an outrageous online post and a broken restraining order, but it became something much bigger. It set a precedent about how important it is for trials to be fair, and how much power judges have, and how carefully we need to protect the right to remain silent. The fact that it went on for so long, with multiple trials and appeals, shows that we're taking these legal principles very seriously.
We are. And it leaves us with a question that's really at the core of our justice system.
Why?
How can we make sure that everyone gets a fair trial, one where the judge is truly impartial, and where the scales of justice are balanced? It's a question we have to keep asking ourselves constantly.
It is, because ultimately fairness is what our legal system should be all about.
Couldn't agree more.